From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. There be not impossibilities enough in religion for an active faith. So wrote Sir Thomas Browne, the 17th century English author and physician. Brown's speculation on the paradoxes of religion underscores two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion about John Calvin, the 16th century theologian, whose writing exerts a continuing influence upon most contemporary Protestantism. Following that, Soundings presents a conversation about rationalistic theology, a set of ideas that flourished in 18th century England. My guests on Soundings are William Bousma of the University of California at Berkeley and William Rowe of Purdue University. Both William Bousma and William Rowe have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. William Bousma is the author of a forthcoming study of John Calvin, who lived from 1509 till 1564. According to William Bousma, the facts of Calvin's life are fairly well established. But missing in the literature about John Calvin is a full understanding of the connections between Calvin's religious discourse and the circumstances of his life, both spiritual and intellectual.
Calvinism is itself a very complex product of its own history. Mm-hmm. What one has to see here is that Calvin's followers in later generations had needs of their own. And they insisted on seeing Calvin as meeting those needs, mm-hmm. needs of the later 16th and of the 17th century. Mm-hmm. What it seems to me that they have tended to do was to take a very lively and at the same time, because it was lively and alive and vital, a confused and messy and extraordinarily rich and imaginative body of thought that moves in many different directions. Reduced it to something much more manageable, much more intelligible, and mm-hmm. something that would above all provide legitimacy to what they wanted to believe.
Mm-hmm. All right, now much, I suppose, might be said about what Calvin's inheritors did to Calvinism, but you, Bill Bousma, are working on a book about Calvin, the man himself, the cultural, social circumstances in which he moved. What were they? What is this core that you are after? You describe Calvin and his thought as lively. That's a pleasant surprise to hear you talk about this great gloomy figure of Puritanism in those terms. Tell me about him.
He wasn't a gloomy figure.
Uh-huh.
He was made a gloomy figure by his followers of the next century, above mm-hmm. all. He was not at all opposed to pleasure. He loved music. He loved wine. And he made a very significant shift within the tradition he had inherited from St. Augustine. Augustine coined a famous phrase about the good things of life, its pleasures and so on. He said they are to be used but not enjoyed.
Uh-huh.
Utor non frui.
Uh-huh.
Calvin changed that. Calvin says they are to be used uh-huh. and enjoyed, mm-hmm. and we should thank God for the pleasure they give us.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Bousma, we associate with Calvin the notions, for instance, original sin, human depravity, election by predestination, some very serious and sobering sorts of theological threads, dogmas, doctrines. In all of this, we shouldn't put this with Calvin? How do we put these two elements together, this rather lively man and his theological system and what has been made of him?
I said earlier that Calvin's own Calvinism
uh-huh.
is messy, confused, contradictory. And the attributes of Calvinism that you've just referred to,
right,
certainly can be found in Calvin.
That is to say, he wrote about these things.
He did write about them,
uh-huh.
And he wrote about them sometimes very vigorously.
Uh-huh.
He was. There's some marvelous passages that denounce sin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
These things are in Calvin, but I use the phrase evangelical humanism to describe his youthful formation at the University of Paris. And the central point about a humanist was that he was a rhetorician.
He could speak and think the question of working abstractions through, writing about them and talking about them.
The essential point about humanist discourse is that it is concerned not so much to state true doctrines,
mm-hmm,
as to achieve results in the world.
Hmm.
And humanists were adept at arguing on both sides of questions. This is one of the ways in which they trained themselves. I think Calvin regarded it as very urgent that human beings should confront their own need for divine grace. And one of the ways of helping them to confront this need in themselves and therefore turn to God for help was to denounce wickedness and vice.
Mm-hmm.
So he does that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when he does so, it must be recognized that I'm not saying that he doesn't believe what he's saying, but that he is more concerned to produce an effect on human beings. He feels this is the urgent need of the times,
mm-hmm,
than he is to state things in a balanced way.
Mm-hmm.
I think Calvin was concerned with piety,
mm-hmm,
rather than with dogma, although there is a dogmatic side to him that, mm-hmm, emerges, especially when he gets upset,
mm,
or is engaging in polemics.
Right. Bill Bousman, let me ask you to pause for a moment and be specific for me. Tell me about one of Calvin's ideas or doctrines, if you want to use that word, notions, that he himself wrote about. Tell me about how he would have viewed such a specific kind of thing, and then tell me about its evolution. How has it come to us? I'm thinking, for instance, again, we talked, I mentioned a moment ago, the Calvinistic doctrines of human depravity or predestination. You may not want to use something as dramatic as that, but...
I think I'd like to talk about predestination.
Fair enough.
In response to that question.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin certainly accepts the doctrine, but he's extremely cautious about it.
Hmm.
He says it's a great mystery, and we should not attempt to worry ourselves about it too much. It's there, it's in the background, but it has a purpose. And the essential thing about it is that it is a source of comfort.
Hmm.
That it has a practical purpose, and
uh-huh,
that we should keep the practical purpose in mind. It's a source of comfort,
mm-hmm,
because the doctrine of predestination really means,
mm-hmm,
that our eternal salvation does not depend on our own works, the works of weak, sinful human beings.
Mm-hmm. The arm of flesh.
But will be taken care of,
right,
by a God who is faithful to his promises.
Mm-hmm.
For Christians, the doctrine of predestination, then, is a doctrine of comfort.
That's rather refreshing to hear, rather than this sort of thunderation coming down from a mountaintop, making you feel bad about being a human being.
But Calvin also thinks that you shouldn't worry about it too much,
mm-hmm,
in your own case, or inquire into God's reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And if you concern yourself with it too much, if you become obsessed with it,
uh-huh,
as many later representatives of this tradition sometimes did, this was a pretty sure sign that you were not among the elect.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I think that what chiefly remains of Calvinism is the perversion of Calvin's own moralism, which is certainly there.
Mm-hmm. For instance, let me stop you on that, Bill Bousma. He wasn't a prig. He wasn't a sort of self-righteous moralizing type. Where's the evidence, pro and con, on a
well, he did. He did an enormous amount of moralizing.
Uh-huh.
I think that, well, this has two sources. One is that as a humanist and a student of the classics, he absorbed a great deal of the severity of the Stoic tradition, mm-hmm. which has often been absorbed into Christianity and tends to make it a kind of moralism rather than the gospel of salvation through grace. Mm-hmm. There's something of that in Calvin. This, I think, was intensified for him by an extraordinary personal anxiety.
About what? His own salvation? His own conduct? What?
Ultimately, I suppose about his own salvation. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is a very diffuse kind of feeling. It's simply a terrible concern about what might happen.
Everybody worries about that, I suppose.
Of course, but some people are obviously more anxious than others.
Right.
And I'm persuaded that Calvin was one of the most anxious people who ever lived.
Uh-huh.
One thing that anxious people do is try to impose a degree of order on their lives mm-hmm. and on their environment as a kind mm-hmm. of insurance against that terrible unknown thing happening.
Mm-hmm. You're telling me, Bill Bousma, that here is Calvin, the original type A.
Here is Calvin, the original type A.
Uh-huh.
And
original sin and original type A.
That's right. He never felt that he had done enough or achieved enough, mm-hmm. and he drove himself mm-hmm. Throughout all his life.
Mm-hmm. Bill Bousma, let's conclude our conversation about John Calvin. You are at the Humanities Center writing what you term a portrait of this theological, historical figure. Let me be rather impertinent. Who gives you the right to go back among these dusty old bones? How is it that, what I'm asking you in a way is, what do you hope to accomplish that's really special here? And how do you know that this is important to a specialized, an academic, as well as a popular audience?
Let me put it first in rather objective terms. Calvin is a figure to whom enormous influence in the shaping of modern Western civilization has been attributed.
Mm-hmm.
He has been variously seen as the father of democracy, of capitalism, of modern individualism, various other important matters.
Mm-hmm.
He's important then to the history of the West, but it's a curious anomaly that historians, with a very few honorable exceptions, have virtually ignored Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
That's one kind of audience. Then there are those who still regard themselves as his followers, who I think have been deprived of an opportunity of getting acquainted with him, even though his influence over their own lives and thoughts remains very deep. I've been quite moved by the number of people who regard themselves as Calvinists who have been supportive of my enterprise
mm-hmm.
And who will come to me after I've made a talk and say, this is the first time I ever thought of John Calvin as a human being. One final point. I'm doing this book for still another audience, namely myself.
Uh-huh.
The ethnicity that is betrayed by my last name
uh-huh.
would make it clear to anything who knows about the Dutch in America that John Calvin has been a very powerful figure somewhere in the background of my own life.
This is a genealogical exercise after a fashion.
If I can understand John Calvin, I think perhaps I can understand myself a lot better.
William Bousma is an historian at the University of California at Berkeley. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a forthcoming study of John Calvin, the 16th century French theologian and religious reformer. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The topics at hand are religion and theology, and Soundings continues now with a discussion featuring another scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. William Rowe of Purdue University is the author of a forthcoming study of Rationalistic Theology, a complex of religious ideas traceable to antiquity that flourished in 18th century England. According to William Rowe, a principal element in rationalistic theology is the extension of reason to questions about religion and the supernatural.
Bill Rowe, you are at the Humanities Center. You have, we got a 50-cent topic on the table here, rationalistic theology. Let's begin with some definitions. What do you mean by that term? What are you after? What are you doing with it?
Well, by rationalistic theology, I mean the attempt to prove conclusively that there exists a God or a being, say, endowed with power and intelligence who created the world. If we think about how people might rationally justify the belief that there's a God, there are several ways you could go about doing it. One we might call experiential theology, and that would be someone who says, well, I know that there's a God because I directly experience God. I hear him talking to me or something like that.
I've seen an angel.
That's right.
Yeah.
By human experience of God, we could justify it. Rationalistic theology is different. It doesn't presuppose any experience of God. It just says, we'll look at the world. We know that there's a physical world. We exist. Those things are certainly true. And we can, by just reasoning from that, prove conclusively that there's a God.
Bill, are you talking, your topic is rational theology. Is this a contradiction in terms to try to bring to the irrational or the mysterious, the supernatural, an element that really properly doesn't belong there?
Some people in the history of reflection about religion have held that if we could prove that there's a God, that would destroy religion, since it would remove faith. And there is that tension, but on the whole, those who have thought and reflected through the centuries about this have held that religion is a matter for reason and reflection and proof, just like anything else in the world. And so I don't regard it as a contradictory. It may be impossible to prove it, and that's another matter, but it's not a contradiction.
Okay. Well, why, you're looking at the 18th century. That's in chronological terms. That, I take it, is important to your investigation. Why would you look at that particular time period? Why not right now? Don't we represent the top of the heap? Aren't we smarter than we've ever been? Why do you have to go back to the 1700s, the 1800s?
I think one reason it flourished is because in the early part of that century, there was just an enormous confidence in the power of human reason to discover the ultimate truths about the world, about God, about ourselves, about our moral duties. This sort of confidence in the power of reason, I think, is reflected in Pope's couplet about Newton. He said, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light."
Right.
And there was that kind of unbounded confidence in the power of reason, not to just tell us about the natural world, but about God, about morality, about ourselves. And so in the early 18th century, everyone thought it could be done. That is, reason was powerful enough to reveal the deepest truths. And so rationalistic theology then flourished.
All right. Now, Bill Rowe, your topic is rationalistic theology. Was this, did that represent a rebellion against something? I mean, give me a sense of what it grew out of immediately.
Well, there was, I think, a rebellion. There was a rebellion against two things, and John Locke led the way.
Now, this is the English philosopher.
English philosopher who was prominent right at the turn of the century. His presence is felt throughout the early part of the 18th century. Everyone was aware of him. He led the attack against something called enthusiasm. And enthusiasm, roughly, was the view that by an inner conviction that God has revealed something to you, you could be certain that that thing was true.
Yeah, it was an emotional kind of thing.
An emotional kind of thing. And all sorts of contradictory claims were made on the basis of enthusiasm.
The reason for that being that it's highly personal, I take it.
It's highly personal, and it doesn't, I mean, the idea was you didn't have to appeal to reason at all.
Right.
Just this inner conviction that God had revealed something to you.
You were full of the Spirit.
Full of the Spirit. Now, Locke led the attack against that. I mean, he didn't claim that God didn't reveal things, but what he said was that, look, if God reveals something, and certainly that's true. God does not lie. Whatever God reveals is true. But whether this thing has been revealed or not is a matter for reason to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said there's no escaping the court of reason. And the deists, who flourished in the early part of the 18th century, took off from Locke and the rationalistic theologians and went from the supremacy of reason, to which they all subscribe, to the sufficiency, all sufficiency of reason. And they discredited revelation altogether. But what was common to all the deists, and there were enormous differences among them, what was common to all of them was the negation of revelation. That reason and reason alone was sufficient. God gave us human reason, and that was sufficient for whatever it is that God requires of us.
Isn't this a matter of great pride? I mean, in the sense of what the Greeks called hubris, that aren't we taking some chances here, assuming that we've got it all inside our skulls, and we're counting on God's generosity that is in fact the case?
Well, you know, they would turn the coin and say, look, it's an enormous upsurge of pride in a person to think that he has a private pipeline to God, and God whispers in his ear, as opposed to the natives somewhere far away. Why has God chosen Moses and us to whisper in our ears rather than other people? What God has done, according to the deists, is give everyone human reason. And he's given everyone something sufficient to discover whatever it is that God demands. That was their line, and they pushed that very strenuously. But they were a minority party, and the main rationalistic theologians kept revelation, thought it was important, but the drift was to the supremacy of reason.
All right, now you mentioned John Locke, again, apropos of your sources. Tell me who else might you be looking at, and name some names for me.
Okay, one figure that I'm quite interested in is a man named Samuel Clarke. He was an Anglican divine and lived the first part of the 18th century, carried on a dispute with Leibniz, was a friend of Newton's, and I think is a very influential and important figure. He was read by Voltaire. Hume read Samuel Clarke's works. He gave a famous series of lectures in 1704 and 05, in which he tried to give his demonstration of God's existence, also tried to demonstrate the truths of morality, and so on. Now, if you examine him, you will get carried forward to Hume, you'll be carried sideways to Leibniz and Collins, you'll be carried backwards to Locke. Clark's principle was this, that whatever exists, no matter how long it exists, even if it exists from eternity, whatever exists, there must be a cause or something that determines it to exist.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just have something exist without there being anything that determines it to exist.
So we're talking about first causes here.
First causes, and he held that principle that it played no favorites. Even God, there must be an explanation for God's existence.
Uh-huh.
You can't just say, well, the world couldn't exist on its own, so we've got now to go to God, mm-hmm. and then say, well, God, he just happens to exist.
Right.
That's all there is to it. for Clark, even the existence of God needs a cause or determining reason.
Well, what does that presuppose? Another God who created God?
No, because then the first God wouldn't really be God.
Right.
So God's existence, what determines his existence, can't be some other being, right?
Uh-huh.
As you know, our existence is determined and brought about by other beings, but God's existence must be determined and brought about, although it's not brought about because God's eternal, but it must be eternally determined to be
mm-hmm.
by something inside God's nature. That is, God, unlike the rest of us, could not fail to be. He's a necessary being, and there's something about his nature which accounts for his existence. Now, it gets very mysterious as to what that is.
Well, Bill Rowe, our topic is rationalistic theology. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do we have here, in other words, not an explanation of where God came from and how he, she, it created the world? We have a kind of device that opens some doors, but not all of them, certainly. Am I being unfair to the topic, or?
No, I don't think so. I think that's right. The device, this fundamental principle that whatever exists, whether it's eternal or not, must have an explanation. This gets you to God,
mm-hmm.
and it gets you something in God's nature that accounts for his existence.
Not proof, necessarily.
Well, if the principle is true, if
uh-huh.
the principle and is known to be true, then it'll get you a proof that there exists a being that wasn't caused by other things.
Depending upon how you define proof.
Well, depending on how you define proof.
Right.
But it does get you there. I think the question then becomes, is this principle, you know, whatever exists must
mm-hmm.
have a cause or explanation of its
mm-hmm.
existence. Is this principle true?
Mm-hmm.
And Clark just thought it was self-evident that if you just thought about it, it's like 2 + 2 = 4. You would just see that it's true. Then
mm-hmm.
the trouble is that when lots of us try to think about it, we don't see that that has to be true.
William Rowe is a professor of philosophy at Purdue University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, William Rowe worked on a forthcoming study of rationalistic theology, the topic of the preceding discussion. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Religion and Theology, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings on Religion and Theology continues next week with two conversations. My guests will be Martin Marty, an historian of modern Christianity at the University of Chicago, and James Wall, editor of Christian Century magazine. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the first in a series of discussions about religion and theology. My guest this week on Soundings will be William Bousma of the University of California at Berkeley and William Rowe of Purdue University. Our topics will be John Calvin, the 16th century French theologian, whose writing exerts a continuing influence on contemporary Protestantism, and rationalistic theology, a set of religious and philosophical ideas that flourished in 18th century England. Religion and Theology, Part 1, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.